Good evening, everyone. My name is Zachary Fetter, and welcome to New Realities on Tuesday night. I started two interviews, a small series, which I believe I'm going to continue, last week on a particular theme that has just been fascinating me for a while now. And I'm actually calling it, in my own mind, a sort of a line drawn in the sand of the spiritual world, right down the middle. And it's just become increasingly clear to me over the time that this is really the case. And it's being done by a couple of organizations, but one in particular. And that's Ken Wilber and Andrew Cohen and Integral Theory and Evolutionary Enlightenment. And last week, I was privileged to speak to Dustin Bitterperner, who was from the Integral side. And this week, I have a new guest who just published his book, 11 Days at the Edge. And before I give his bio, I just want to start by saying a little something. While I was reading this book, I couldn't help but continue thinking about this story that I've always loved about how Hulk Hogan discovered his trainer that ultimately he would go on to sort of forge his career with. And the story basically goes that he walked into this gym and saw this guy, and he said, "You know, I want to be a wrestler." And the guy turned to him and said, "Really? You really want to be a wrestler?" And then proceeded to purposefully break his leg. And Hogan, of course, went off. And about 8 months later, he came back and he said, "I want you to be my trainer." And I've always liked that story. And as I was reading this book about evolutionary enlightenment, I really thought that there were some comparisons. And if you're the sort of person who really wants something that's going to take you to task and really yearning for something that ultimately is going to demand the best of you, this may be the sort of path for you. So my guest has been deeply involved in the spiritual world for over 25 years. He met Andrew Cohen some 14 years ago and watched his teaching develop from a radical call for personal enlightenment to an equally radical call to enlightenment beyond the individual with global implications. And we're going to be talking about those as well. These aren't just puff words, I can assure you. After monumental struggles, he watched him succeed with the body of his students in giving birth to the first seeds of a new stage of human evolution. And those two may just sound like a bunch of words, but I guarantee we're going to go into them because it's quite startling and it really is revolutionary. As a writer, he long desired to chronicle the development of this teaching and has done with his book that we're going to be talking about, 11 Days at the Edge. He's also working on a new book, The Purpose-Driven Cosmos, Evolution, The Search for Meaning, and the Rebirth of Spiritual Heroism. And spiritual heroism is really what this teaching is all about, as far as I can see. He also has a business as a dog trainer. And he currently teaches courses on evolutionary enlightenment around the Bay Area and on the West Coast. Michael Wambacher, it's really a privilege to talk to you this evening. Thank you so much for joining me.
Well, thank you for having me. It's a privilege to be on your program, and I'm very excited about the interview tonight.
Yeah. So I want to start immediately, Michael, there are two places I want to start. I'm going to have to just pick one. And the first one is really, Andrew Cohen and this evolutionary enlightenment ultimately is putting evolution back into the hands of the individual. It's no longer something that descends and you sort of have to wait for it. His whole philosophy is quite different. He really is saying that you can grasp it yourself.
Oh yeah, I mean, I think that's the key thing. I mean, when you say putting it back into the hands, I would frame it a little bit differently. It's just for the first time, you know, because evolution more or less has been an automatic process until very recently. But you know, with the emergence of the kind of consciousness that you and I have, and the, you know, the kind of life circumstances we're in, a position, you know, now that the whole, you know, essentially the whole evolutionary process has fallen into human hands and into the power of human choice. You know, and there are all kinds of implications to that. So it's in a way, it's waking up to this possibility for the first time. You know, where are we going as a species? This is on offing now for the first time, really ever. I just wanted to kind of make that distinction. I mean, I think it's, I don't know if you were using the term evolution, you know, in sort of in terms of the inner evolution, which is, you know, in the sort of Rudolf Steiner kind of sense, you know, that. You know, because that always has been to a large degree in the individual's hands, but
No, I think you're right to correct me. In fact, I mean, the way that he does it is radical and it is original. And I mean, could you just give us a taste? Because I don't want to put, I don't want to put words in your mouth. But I really want just to, if you could explain how he's asking people to adopt the posture of enlightenment, to seize enlightenment, without having anything to do with their interior experience. Because that's radical in itself.
Well, certainly was a radical discovery for me, that particular posture. I think, and this is something we've actually talked, some of us that are students of Andrew's have talked about quite a bit, just even in recent weeks, about this phrase that the path and the goal are one. Mm. And the way Andrew Cohen speaks about it is that, if you have a spiritual experience, if you have a very profound experience of spiritual enlightenment, spiritual awakening, you start to see in a particular way. There's a perspective, it's spontaneous, but there's a perspective that emerges in your own experience, along with the state of consciousness that is, kind of spontaneous. Now, that perspective actually can be cultivated in the absence of the state of consciousness and can be adopted and assumed. The enlightened perspective on one's own experience can be adopted and assumed through intention and will, even when the particular, the kind of ecstatic state of consciousness maybe isn't there. And there's a lot in that. I mean, it's very powerful. It's very, very powerful. There's the capacity to adopt the enlightened perspective in relationship to all of your own experience, because you choose to, once you've had enough, a certain amount of experience and training in that perspective, it puts one's own transformation in one's own hands in a way that just waiting for experience or trying to cultivate more experiences just won't. And you're right, it's very radical and very empowering.
Yeah. As I was reading this book, it's a big book, and it's totally worthy of, it's funny when you read a quote from someone like Barbara Marx Hubbard, who smack on the bang of the front cover says, "Epic in scope and purpose." You open the first page with a little bit of a sort of eyebrow raised. But, by the end of it, I'm like, oh my God, I mean, was it ever?
Well, thank you.
No, yeah, and I'm sorry to do that, considering most of the book is about destroying the ego. I'm sorry to... you must be having a hard time with such a great accomplishment.
It's always nice. Look, every author likes to have people say nice things about their work, so I'm very much appreciating your appreciation of the book.
Yeah, it really is... it's authentic, and what I noticed was, as I was reading it, was... as I said, it's a big book. It's about 500 pages, and I probably took 5 days to read it because the text is thick. It's not, it's not a page turner in terms of a romance or an adventure story. I mean, this is deep stuff. This is as deep as it gets. Mm-hmm. And it's more like, I mean, it was felt like the greatest workshop I never went on for 11 days because the articulation that Andrew Cohen brings to the enlightenment path, as far as I'm aware, I mean, I've pretty much read everything I can get my hands on over my lifetime, and I have not found that level of articulation. And this sort of brings me to the second point that is, and each of these, of course, can be unpacked to so much, to such a degree, but the second point that was so jarring to me and so just made me feel so passionate about what was going on in terms of that movement was the fact that the more articulate he got, the more you realize that if you have experienced the ground of being, if anyone has experienced any form of samadhi, as you said, to a certain extent, they've felt the truth. And implicit in that is a responsibility. And I mean, that was a sort of a gulp moment for me. I mean, could you talk about that? Because that was huge for me.
Well, yeah, I think it's one of the most compelling parts, at least for my own self and in my experience, it's one of the most compelling parts of the teaching is that if once you know a certain amount through your own direct experience, there actually is a moral obligation to act on that, and it's this emphasis on action, on doing in the world, and the moral dimension of the spiritual life that grabbed my attention from the very first time I met Andrew Cohen back in 1994. And like you also said, I was completely struck and dumbfounded by not only the transmission of, enlightened consciousness that is always the field that's around him, but by his ability to articulate the finest points of enlightenment, of the spiritual life, of the philosophical, ethical implications. I just had never heard anyone speak like that. And, you know, even back in those days, like 1994, I think I first met him, you know, he was really bringing the moral dimension into play. And he used to say things like, you know, basically he was to make the point that he wasn't all that interested in how, you know, what any individual would think or feel in terms of the experiences they've had and so forth. He was always more interested in what they did and how they lived, because in what they did and how they lived, one could find, you know, one could determine the deepest conclusions that they've drawn about what's true in life. You know, and I just thought that was just so real and authentic and clearly true. You know, and I was very, very, very compelled by that and challenged, you know, and you know, it's both compelling and challenging. Yeah. And, you know, as you and I were talking a little bit before, you know, the interview started, I think in a lot of the postmodern spirituality, really the emphasis is on having fantastic experiences and feeling good. And there's very little emphasis other than be compassionate. I mean, there's very little emphasis really on the rigorous moral dimension. And the sort of moral ethical implications of spiritual revelation. And so, yeah, it's a very powerful dimension.
Yeah, yeah. And that's sort of why I brought up that story in the beginning, which I really was thinking about the whole way through, because it really felt like, you know, this was a teaching. And tell me what you think about this. I was feeling like this is a teaching for people who sort of want to go pro in a way. You know, it's really no BS, and really. And your book does this so well, obviously, because it does have Andrew's words in it. I mean, it does have the Dharma right there, spoken on every single day that you chart one after the other. I mean, how much is this book? I'm trying to pick it up. I mean, how much does this book cost? It's like $22.95. I mean, that is just a ridiculous price for what you're giving people, you know, in 500 pages. I mean, I just have to bring that up, because I mean, I don't think I've read a book that is so complete, because I mean, it really covers the evolutionary enlightenment posture, more or less. I mean, it gives an incredible overview, but it really gives a call to arms. And it's, I mean, that's why I brought up that story in the beginning, that, I mean, for me, and it shouldn't be, because as you mentioned with the spiritual world, this is what I was sort of feeling when I was describing that line in the sand, that he's asking for people to behave in an enlightened way, regardless of how they feel. And I mean, let me ask you then another question. Let me take devil's advocate for a minute, because I have to say I was really bought by the book. I mean, I was totally there, and it changed the way I think about my own practice. It certainly challenged me. I mean, it was, you know, he didn't break my arm, but there were a lot of psychological bruises by the end of it. There really were.
Wow.
And I think that's excellent. I mean, that's why I bring that story up, because I think Andrew Cohen, he's the sort of teacher that's perfect for someone who really wants to be taken to their edge. So just to play devil's advocate, and I have to do a little bit of that, how does basically adopting the posture of enlightenment change? How is it different, rather, from what most people are doing just in most days, trying to be good, trying to do the right thing?
Well, I mean, I think it's a complex question. I mean, first of all, trying to be good and trying to do the right thing is probably a really good idea. And, you know, I think, maybe we can start with, you know, one of the definitions of integrity that I've always been most taken by, which is, you know, how much are we really living in accordance with the deepest thing that we've realized? So, you know, because, you know, what does it mean to be good? You know, what does it mean to be good? I mean, you know, if you're a good Taliban, aficionado, you know, you do all kinds of unspeakable things. So I think, in terms of what it is to be good in this, as I understand it, is the deepest spiritual experience, the deepest experience of truth that any of us has ever had. How true are we to that in terms of, you know, the implications of it for our life, you know, in terms of really endeavoring to live that, you know, and that's, you know, that's a serious question. And, yeah, you know, but there's a kind of simplicity to it also that makes that it is what gives it its power.
Yeah, let's unpack this a little bit, because I feel like this is one of those things where, at least in my experience of reading the book and of knowing evolutionary enlightenment for a while, it was one of those things where, you know, it was like the onion. Like, I thought I understood it, and then I would understand it deeper and then deeper and then deeper, and then there would be a breaking point. And I sort of wonder, there, you know, probably people who are listening who might be saying, you know, hey, I lead a good spiritual life. You know, I'm on myself. I try to be present. you know, I do all the things, but this teaching is, that's, it's a little tougher than that. I mean, for example, let's take one of the items, which is bearing it, you know, basically the idea of bearing your suffering.
Right.
And being compassionate enough to others in that you simply would not, you know, like who is it? Philip Seymour Hoffman used to say, I can't stand when people think that their baggage is your news.
That's a great line.
It's a great one. You know? And I mean, that is so much our world. And I mean, the spiritual world, you know, it has its own stuff. I mean, we've been moving around the spiritual world for a while. So I think everyone has a handle on that. And I mean, could you just talk to us about the evolutionary enlightenment community? Because that was probably my first, that was what I was exposed to first. And I was walking around this community, and you know, I've walked around a lot of spiritual communities. I mean, always, every time, there's always something, what's going on, what's this, what's that. This was the first community I walked around. I was like, holy cow, something's going on here. These guys are holding it together in the most implacable and integral way. I mean, these guys are just, you know what I mean? There's a level of maturity, and they're just holding a line. Mm. Could you just talk about that? Because I'm sure that I would love to unpack this so people really get an idea that this is not just, you know, being more present with your breath or something.
Yeah, no, right, exactly. So, I would like to take a crack at that. I mean, it's a multi-level, multi-dimensional answer, but I want to maybe step back and set up a little bit of context, because you used the phrase earlier about, you know, I use this in the book a lot about, you know, just bearing the willingness to bear your own experience in the service of something higher. Mm. But I think we have to set a little context for your listeners, because, you know, and I'll just do that. I mean, one of the things that Andrew Cohen had really pioneered is, like, I think from when he first began teaching, very early on in his teaching career, he intuited that, like, but the way he tells it, you know, he was watching a group of his students who were spiritually intoxicated after, you know, after some kind of a teaching that he had given or whatever, you know, that had been a powerful transmission. And then he was just sort of sitting back and watching the kind of ecstatic state that some of his students were in when they were speaking to one another about what they were experiencing from the experience itself. There was something else emerging. And he intuited that there is some kind of collective dimension to awakening, to enlightenment, that transcends the individual. And this, you know, this is something he began to pursue with a very, very, very seriously committed core group of people for, you know, quite a bit of time. Now, as I hear these stories, I was not part of that whole thing. You know, even a lot of his own students didn't really understand what he was pushing for, but anyway, it wasn't about an individual attainment of enlightenment, even though that was, you know, that was part of it. But it was about a collective emergence that he intuited was possible. And then basically in July 30th of 2001, there was a kind of real powerful emergence of this kind of collective awakening. That was, you know, and I was fortunate enough about a year after that, a year, year and a half after that, to be on a retreat that I speak about in the book. Actually, this is where the phrase bearing it came from. Where some of Andrew's senior students at the time sort of devised a methodology to kind of bring this emergence into being with groups of people, and they were trying it with new people, and I was one of those new people. And so the idea is basically that, where to start? I mean, the emergence itself is this higher consciousness. There's a new being that emerges in the room between people. That is completely dependent upon all the people in the room, basically leaving their egos behind and focus, you know, putting their attention on the authentic, you know, what Andrew Cohen calls the authentic self part of themselves, and choosing through intention and training and will to disregard their ego, even if it's screaming in their face. And you know, and what's amazing is that one can do that. And when we did that together with, you know, because we were being led in this particular group by some very senior people of Andrew Cohen's who had helped pioneer this, something ruptured in the room. And I described that in quite some detail in the book, where there was a kind of explosion or a vortex in consciousness that opened up. And there was about 30 of us that opened up between us that is very difficult to describe. I mean, it's a radical kind of unity. But you got that it had its own being. I mean, the best metaphor I ever heard for it was, like, you know, basically God waking up to him, her, itself in its own creation through a group of individuals. but it's its own force, you know, and there's a kind of ecstasy and power, but it radically, you got that it's not about individual enlightenment, it's a collective event that a group of people can, you know, we're consciously able to bring into being. I mean, it's very difficult to describe, but the thing is, it radically transcends the significance of any of the individuals. It's a new potential for our humanity.
Yeah,
that's collective, but that also transcends the importance of individuals. It's how consciousness can evolve through groups of people and become more and more and more active in the world that it created, or the mystery behind, the mystery at the root or the bottom of life, exploding. I mean, you could use the God word. I mean, when it goes really deep, I mean, that's the sense that you get, is that God is waking up to him, her, its own existence, through this room full of creatures, and again, the best metaphor I ever heard from it, it must be like a baby that's waking up, or that's becoming aware for the very first time that the hand that it's been looking at is actually its own. And wow, I can do things with it. You know, I think very young infants, they're not aware that their body's really their own. And there must be some moment where the baby holds out the hand in front of itself and looks at the fingers and moves them and go, oh, these are mine. I can do things with these, you know. And in a sense, that's kind of, it's a good metaphor with what can happen in a group like that. You know, you say, oh my God, this power comes through. All the individuals are required. And then at the same time, they become animated by that power that's in the room. I mean, suddenly you hear people speaking with a wisdom and a depth and a spontaneity and an authenticity and a transparency that if you know them individually, as you know, that just isn't part of who they normally are, because they've chosen to sort of leave the ego behind and do what's necessary to facilitate this new emergence. I mean, I don't know if that's making any sense.
It does.
But in relation to the bearing it, and on this particular retreat, I was having, I mentioned this quite a bit in the book, I was having an incredibly difficult time. I mean, I thought, you know, I mean, I was really, really, really struggling with my own inner experience, with panic, with anxiety, and with all sorts of kind of neurosis and self-obsession. But it was kind of, that was really eating at me all day long. But I found when we entered those discussion groups, I was able to, because of the training and because of this, this training we were getting, to basically disregard that part of my own experience and be willing to bear the discomfort of it, but put my attention on the other part of myself that, you know, the authentic self, the deeper self dimension that was untouched by any of that. Put my attention there and on the conversation that was happening in the middle of the room and choose actively to disregard all the rest of it. And in doing that, and all of us did that, all of us, 30 or 35 people that were in the room, did that. And it facilitated this emergence, again, because of the leadership that was in the room. But this emergence was facilitated by our willingness to bear our own emotional difficulties and whatever we were having and put our attention on a part of ourself that isn't that. And then this thing erupted. And, I mean, I don't know if that makes sense.
Well, it certainly does to me. And I mean, in the book, this is definitely one of the most just profound moments. I mean, and you describe it so well. And I mean, at that point, it does turn into a page turner. I mean, it's certainly a page turner in terms of your own experience, which makes it so powerful, because on the one side, you've got Andrew's teaching, which is basically just relentless. I mean, it's like the Hogan story. He's relentlessly just tearing at you. And, you know, obviously if you want it and you're hungry for it, I mean, it's incredibly, it's like, you know, jumping into an ice cold bath, you know, it's incredibly invigorating and it's incredibly inspiring. And on the other hand, you've got your story, which is just incredibly touching because, I mean, I don't think I've read a book, that goes into so much depth and detail with articulation to do with a philosophy that is so integral. That evolutionary enlightenment really is. And after reading this book, I can, you know, like I said to you on the, you know, before we started the call, you know, I can actually stand behind this. I can put, you know, like the math here, I can say, I vouch for this. I put my name behind this. I really do, because I don't see a flaw in it. I really see it as an incredibly integral teaching, that I've been, you know, it's absolutely got me, and it's taken me this long to really sort of sniff that out. And then
That's how I feel. I mean, that's how I feel, you know, and it's cool. I mean, it's cool that you're saying that, because I, again, in today's sort of kind of postmodern spiritual culture, it's almost considered a poor,
faux pas.
Yeah, poor taste to really stand behind something with a kind of absolute and firm conviction. You know, I mean, everything is kind of very, very soft around the edges and very, you know, relativistic and everything. And just and so anyway, I'm just appreciating the conviction that you're expressing.
Yeah,
about something that I've been convinced about, you know, for some time now. It's refreshing.
Yeah, well, it's funny. As I was finishing the book, I really felt that. I started to watch myself, and I go, "My God, I'm." On the one hand, I feel my cynicism for all these years of always looking at a teaching and saying, being let down by a teaching or being let down by a teacher or whoever, you know, which we've all experienced, which you also recount very touchingly in your book. And then, as I'm reading this, and as I know the community, I mean, there was this ongoing repetitive. I can't believe it is. Yeah. Is this actually going to stand up to my rigorous critical thinking and my absolute, you know, acid test of scrutiny? Is it going to hold up? And at the end of the book, it totally held up. And I found myself putting it down and just sort of staring into space, thinking, my God, I can, almost like, you know, the cynicism that's in the spiritual world for some of us who've been in it for a while. I sort of was looking at it, and it was almost like when someone has been in prison for 50 years and someone says to them, "You're innocent. You're going to leave now." And you don't quite hear it. You think, am I actually going to be able to stand up and sort of say, I'm behind this? The window shopping may be over. So that, you know,
That's cool you said, because the window, because we live in a, you know, as far as spiritual stuff goes, I mean, you know, we do live in a window shopping culture. You know, you can, and I think, you know, and this is something I was just speaking with somebody else about the other day, is that, I mean, obviously, you know, there's been a reaction against all the kind of absolutisms from the past. And, you know, and we have the kind of incredible privilege now to have all the world's traditions at our fingertips. And then you can really explore. And I mean, I certainly did that for a long time myself. You know, you wanted to have a little bit of this and a little bit of that just to check it all out. Yeah. But I think it's very easy to confuse multiple options and doing a lot of things with depth. And I just realized a long time ago, for whatever reason, I don't really know. I mean, I was saying to you earlier, you know, I was in the part of the New Age movie when it was still new back in the early 80s. But at a certain point, I realized, you know, it's not taking me any deeper. I want something deeper. And that's, you know, that started me on the search for my first, you know, for the first teacher that I was with, who I spent 13 years with. But yeah, it's true. You know, there's an enormous amount of cynicism about what's possible out in the spiritual world. And also there's a kind of sense, I mean, I think there's a kind of mistaken belief that lots of options and doing a lot of different things and tasting a little bit of this and a little bit of that equates to depth. And I mean, I know from my own experience, it just doesn't. At a certain point, I think for anybody who's very serious about going very deeply in their own spiritual life, you know, not just with evolutionary enlightenment, but with whatever, that you have to just decide, okay, I'm taking this particular thing I'm taking deeply. And then, you know, basically put the rest of it aside, you know. And I mean, that's happened to me twice in my life. And I talk about that in the book. You know, the first time I met my first teacher and spent 13 very committed years with him. And then, you know, now with Andrew Cohen.
Yeah. And I want to dovetail back to, are you calling it the we space, or is that a trite reduction of what it is?
You mean the emergence?
Yeah, just to give it a word that we can use just to understand what we're talking about.
I mean, I think that word, that phrase has been used a lot. I think it's a fine word, but I don't think it quite captures.
Yeah. So the emergence,
the emergence of what it is that happens in the we space. I mean, obviously the we space is, you know, when we all come together, there's the intersubjective space between us.
Right. We have to remind people it's not when we play video games together. It's completely different.
But there's something, you know, but it's not, you know, when this is really firing, when this potential is really emerging, it transcends the individuals. It's, you know, the individuals hold the we space open, but what comes through is something else. It's, you know, it's a kind of radical higher state of consciousness where there's a kind of, I mean, again, as I described it in the book, your own experience at that moment is that it's enlightened. I mean, you cannot tell where you end and the other begins in the most positive way. You know, I mean, one of the traditional spiritual sayings in enlightenment traditions is there are no others. you literally, the boundaries just fall away. And all you just see is one self in the room with 30, you know, sets of eyes and 30, you know, it's just 30 bodies, one self. And that's kind of a visceral felt experience. At the same time, you know, you have never in your life felt more like yourself, more autonomous, more creatively free, more empowered as a so-called individual than at that very moment. So these kind of two contradictory things come together, or seemingly contradictory things, which is, you know, autonomy and this communion, come together in a very powerful way. That is, you know, it's difficult to describe, but once you know it, once you taste that, you never forget it, and you see that, oh, this kind of coming together, where there's only one self and everybody knows it experientially. At the same time, you're more creatively empowered because all the trust barriers are melted. You know, there's a kind of total trust, so you can just let go. There's the fear boundaries. I mean, you just feel more like yourself as an individual than you ever have in your entire life. At the same time, you really can't tell where you end and the other begins. And then there's a kind of creative force that comes through that kind of consciousness that is from, anyway, it's just very, very powerful. And you get that it's the source itself coming into the room through this kind of committed engagement in an incredibly focused, intense way, and that it wants to go somewhere. It wants to go into the future. It wants to create new potentials, you know, through us in this world, you know, in this world that so desperately needs help of all sorts. It wants to enter into that world with kind of spiritually empowered creative potentials that we can maybe intuit a little bit, but now we can't really see in any kind of, you know, intellectually manufactured way.
Right. And I would love to give some people a little bit of history about this emergence, because the way that you recounted in the book, it's definitely one of those moments where I gulped and I suddenly felt incredibly grateful. You know, I sort of started to choke up because those who have been in the spiritual world for a while, you know, they know that Andrew has some controversy to him. And I think after, you know, a year and a half of going into this, I think I understand why. And it's not, I think, what people just at a glance will think, like, you know, he's this or he's that. I really understand that to a certain extent where some of that comes from. And I think some of it does come, as you explain in the book, from his relentless fight to try to forge this emergence with some of his early students. And I have to really just compliment you, Michael, on the way that you describe this, because I think it's in one of your appendices. It's at the back of the book. I mean, you know, right in the middle of it, you put a little line for the actual history of this, go to appendices 6. And I mean, I just went straight there. And it was amazing, because there's this one quote that I'll probably never forget, when Andrew is looking around at some people today who were experiencing it. And he said, you know, don't take this for granted. There are blood on these walls. And by that, I know he means psychological blood. You know, people, some of his early students, and I'd love you to go more into this, because it just choked me up just to hear, when you really understand that a lot of these early students, you know, this was something that didn't exist at all. And he drove so hard, to the extent where I think some people, you know, just might not have had it in them. I mean, who knows? I don't have no idea what happened, but clearly people were upset and people left, and he had, you know, failures. Like Edison.
Yeah, that's a good analogy. Yeah, I mean, you know, I just to kind of touch on that event that you spoke about, you know, we were at this retreat where we had, you know, and I think it was this same retreat that I had this amazing experience with this lucky group of 30 other people. That was the first time after the initial emergence of that, you know, of what he had worked so hard for with this incredibly committed, serious, like kind of spiritual band of spiritual heroes, you know, that really stuck with him through this, and that had forged this into being after something like 10 or 12 years of really pushing at it. And then I was fortunate enough to be in the, you know, because they wanted to try an experiment to see, can this work? If a few people with that, you know, from that with that level of commitment who'd really been with him through this, could they take other people who really, you know, weren't part of that world, you know, we're just coming in from the outside, you know, for a retreat. Could they also be taken in, or could this only happen between people that were just unbelievably, you know, committed and had given their entire lives to this? And you know, so it was an experiment, and I was part of that experiment. And we had, you know, it was extraordinary what happened between us. I mean, it was really off the charts, you know, in a lot of the dimensions that I was just speaking about. And then he made this comment at the end, because, you know, you're in a space, we were all in a state of spiritual intoxication that just went on for days and days and days. And it's easy, again, I think partially to do with postmodern culture, we take everything so for granted. You know, it's like, hey, we paid our money for the retreat, so therefore we're entitled to an experience like that. And you don't slow down often to just really appreciate the deeper dimensions of what, you know, and what has been given to you here. And that, you know, and that, you know, and to have some reverence, and also that there's a kind of obligation that goes with it. But that's when he made that statement. He goes, you guys have to realize, you know, the state that you're experiencing now, you know, don't be casual about it. There's blood all over these walls. People bled for this, to bring this into being. And and there's a whole history of you know, how he had to work with people to get this thing to emerge. And it's extraordinary. I know a lot of those people that, you know, because there's, they're, you know, ones that are still there with Andrew. I mean, to me, they're spiritual heroes of the highest order. You know, because I think, as I understand it, and as I hear, because I was not part of this, but as I hear the stories told, most of them didn't have any idea what Andrew was pushing for.
Yeah. That was the most fascinating thing for me.
You know, they just decided to trust their teacher, and they did. And you know, and then on July 30th, 2001, this thing ruptured finally. You know, after an incredible, intense period of spiritual practice, of pushing. You know, and it's just nothing short of heroic and extraordinary. And I don't know, you know, I don't know if the culture can even really appreciate it. I mean, it's so. Yeah, it's just heroic, you know, to me, it's just heroic. And I think it's just good. It's good to have some reverence and awe and respect for that dimension of it, and for the miracle of spirit in the world in general, you know, that I think just isn't there. I don't see it in a lot of postmodern spirituality. I see, you know, a lot of casualness and flippancy. And not a kind of deep soul level kind of rigor and, you know, kind of commitment and seriousness and maturity.
Yeah, all these words that you know, God love the new age that I am, you know, a part of. These are words that are not really liked. You know, things like rigor. You know,
right, because it all sounds very fascist and linear, and yeah. You know, you shouldn't be in your head so much. You should just kind of be, and you know, I mean, I did all that, and it just, I mean, I think in terms of, you know, you can have tons of spiritual experiences and not really fundamentally have it change you that much until you decide you want to become a different person, and all the kind of moral implications in that, and that's just, you know, how that is just different for, but it's different for everybody. But I just think in today's spiritual culture, there isn't enough of that. And that's one of the things, again, that's attracted me so strongly over the years to Andrew Coleman and continues right until this very moment, is this kind of relentless demand for ever higher degrees of integrity with respect to the things you know to be true.
Yeah.
And based on your own experience, not based on what somebody else told you. I mean, that has to be said, right? I mean, you can't be, you know, there's no demand to be accountable to things other people have told you. But once something becomes a real part of your own experience, then what, you know?
Yeah. To be clear with people, he really is most demanding if you have had, you know, a small enlightenment or a samadhi experience or, you know, a Kensho experience. I mean, if you've experienced the ground of being in meditation and you can say, yes, I have, then you're in trouble with him. Then the responsibility starts. But it, up until that moment, he does say, you know, am I correct in saying that he suggests that you need to have that? You need to have that reference point, or else it's true. You're just, you know.
Well, I would just say one thing. I wouldn't say you're in trouble with him. It's like that's when you say the gateway to transformation is really open, and all the potential inherent in that, you know, is now, you know, now the question becomes, are we going to take advantage of what we know to really transform? So it's not, you know, I don't think it's a question of being in trouble. I think it's just a question of being, you know, at some soul level held accountable for what you know. And then, you know, but the thing is, to me, that's all good news, because it means the doorway to transformation is like wide open, you know. And then, of course, you know, the job of a teacher is then to help, cajole, encourage, push, you in that direction. That is the job of the spiritual teacher, as I understand it. But I wouldn't frame it necessarily as being in trouble. I mean, your ego might be in trouble.
Yeah, I guess for me, certainly what I've felt is it's my, so you're right. It's not that I'm in trouble with him, but it's that it's really, it's my conscience. And when I say that, it's funny, you know, so many things that I disliked about Andrew in the beginning, I'm starting to understand more now as things that I didn't necessarily want to see. And I really hope that doesn't sound like some sort of Andrew Cohen convert. It really isn't. It has nothing to do with him. But, you know, when, for example, he said things like, you know, this is for the leading edge. This teaching is for the leading edge. He said that many times. And for a while, I didn't really understand what that meant. I know what the words mean, but, you know, what exactly is he talking about? And I mean, you tell me, my understanding of that now is that the leading edge are the people who are, let's say, most sensitive, most in touch with their conscience. Because I think he uses there's a quote in there in your book where he says, when people meet me, a timer starts, like the clock starts. And at some point, they're going to have to face that music. And for me, at least, I had very clear experiences of that. And it was not, it had nothing to do with Andrew Cohen. It has to do, he articulates the path that my conscience takes to awakening to the responsibility that it has to honor what I know to be true.
I mean, it's beautiful the way you put that. It's exactly, I mean, I couldn't add anything to it to make it better than what you just said. It's absolutely true. It's between, you know, there's something opens up between you and your deeper spiritual conscience, you know. And again, I mean, these are things that aren't very often talked about these days. But again, in terms of, you know, in terms of making bringing the potential for real transformation alive, you know, in your own experience in a way that, I mean, you know, I think a lot of us, you know, you mentioned the cynicism in the spiritual world a little bit earlier. I mean, I think, you know, when we're young, if we have spiritual experiences when we're young, we're very excited and we're not cynical. But then as 10 years roll by, 20 years roll by, 30 years roll by, and we still haven't, quote unquote, got enlightened, then, it, you know, it's easy to become cynical. And, you know, and anyway, and I mean, being around somebody like Andrew Cohen and really, you know, kind of opening yourself, the potential is there to destroy all that cynicism. But then when you destroy all the cynicism, you know, I mean, the cynicism offers a lot of protection, right? Because if you believe that nothing's really possible, then you don't have to act as if it were. But once you see, oh, no, something dramatic is possible, you know, then, you know, again, like you said earlier, there's a kind of moral dimension that opens, your conscience starts to awaken. And I mean, I think that's, that's a good thing. Even, you know, even if, you know, for certain part of ourselves, it can be uncomfortable. But, you know, that's the kind of confrontation I think we all want to have sooner rather than later, so that we have whatever bit of life we have to address it, to change, to, you know, become the kind of person that in our best moments we want to be not for its own sake, but for a higher purpose.
Yeah. That was another one of those realizations that I had reading your book, that he said many times, context is everything. And, you know, if your enlightenment is just a tiny context of you awakening, it's not going to motivate you very much. But if it's in the context of a 14 billion year process, and you are the leading edge. And this is something I had read and heard, you know, 25, 30 times, and I'm just hearing it, and I'm just hearing sounds. Okay, that's pretty. And somehow in your book, you know, I really, and I don't say that to flatter you. I mean, the book is very powerful, and it really sort of bangs that home, that if you really take that upon yourself to be part of that, and don't get me wrong, the community of evolutionaries who I've met, I can't keep going back to them enough, you know, you included, that for spiritual individuals out there who are still shopping around, you have to check out this community, because the way I see it is that this is the sort of the spiritual individual of the future is, and they're highly professional. They're not wonky. They're not doing weird stuff. You know, they're totally undercover and they're absolutely resolute with their practice and their posture.
Well, I appreciate that. I mean, I have to say, you know, just to kind of second that point, I mean, when I was basically sniffing around the edges there, you know, I mean, I had known Andrew Cohen for some time, like I said, since 1994, but during that time I was involved with another teacher in a very serious way. But I was always so impressed when I would meet his, you know, his closest students. I was just like, wow, what is it about these people? These are serious people. These people that, you know, there's integrity, there's depth, there's strength, there's a kind of uprightness. It's like, man, I want to, you know, I mean, I think I say that in the book. It's like, I want to be like that.
Yeah.
You know, and I mean, to, you know, it's, so because it's one thing, you know, you see, you know, it's Andrew Cohen, so you see this enlightened, you know, incredibly enlightened, powerful spiritual teacher. But there's the gulf between you and an individual like that. This was my experience at any rate. You know, in terms of attainment, the gulf between myself and somebody like that is so far that it's easy to just not put them in the same category as yourself. Just say, well, that is just unattainable. That is just some kind of, you know, I don't know, it's something else. But then when you meet people, you know, that more or less started just like you, and that under this individual's guidance and tutelage have become these impressive individuals, both men and women, and the impressiveness always has kind of the same flavor. I mean, they're unique individuals, obviously, but the flavor of the depth and the seriousness and the maturity always has this. It has the same quality, which is the enlightenment quality. It's like, oh my God, that's so that, you know, when I saw that, I was like, oh, that could be me. You know, that could be me. If I give myself to this in a way that these people have given themselves to it, then that kind of strength, dignity, self-respect, power, you know, unselfconscious sort of spiritual authority and power, that also, you know, is something that could start happening in you.
And they're not, it's nothing like, you know, sort of Stepford Wives for the women or Scientologists for the men. You know, they're not glassy-eyed, staring, you know. I mean, look, hey, I did the Dianetics course, okay, so I was there, and there is a bit of a staring thing going on with the Scientologists. You know, I respect their path, but it's not the same thing. It really isn't. You know, this is more of a groovy bunch who have their who walk the line. So I just wanted to throw that in because, you know, it's funny when we talk about these things, Michael, that I've got a New Ager in my head on one side and a cynic on my head on the other. And we can say all these things, and because all these words are so saturated with meaning and so many different people are using maybe not the exact same combinations, but certainly like a large proportion of the vocabulary, it can often just sound like so many other things if you're not listening too carefully. So,
right, and that's why it's important, I think, to just, I mean, for anybody who's interested in this sort of thing, just to go find out for themselves, you know? I mean, ultimately, you know, you're right. It's...
it's a perfect moment to mention the retreat. I do want to talk about the retreat, as you know, just because it's coming up, and it is a special thing, especially considering this is the emergence of this, you know, very pioneering emergence. I mean, that's what it is. I'd love you to say something about it. It's not your average retreat.
Well, no, there's a number of events coming up, but I mean, the big main event every year is the Being and Becoming retreat that this year is going to be in Tuscany, Italy. It's basically, there's two parts of it. And you can attend either part, but the first part is a 10-day silent retreat led by Andrew Cohen, and it's just 10 days of meditation and going basically into, you know, traditional enlightened consciousness, with him there basically fueling the entire event. And I've done two of these, and it's just incredibly powerful. I mean, it's hard to describe. So then you do that for 10 days. You just go into, you know, you just let everything go. You just go into this deepest dimension of your own self. And then the next 10 days, you go, you know, you emerge from that ground and then explore the evolutionary implications, the evolutionary dimension of enlightenment, which is the new thing that Andrew Cohen is bringing to the table. And then you start to see how all this fits together. So this is kind of a three-week mega retreat that is, you know, if you can do both parts of it, it's an unbelievable, life changing experience that, it's extraordinary. There's usually 300-400 people there, and you're spending, again, either, you know, 10 days to 3 weeks with these people in this, you know, saturated field of consciousness with Andrew guiding it. I mean, I just can't say enough about it. And again, you know, I think 3 weeks is a long time for a lot of people. It's split into these two things so that people can attend one or the other or both. And, you know, you can find out more about it by by going to the Enlighten Next homepage, which is enlightennext.org. That's Enlighten Next with two N's in the middle, .org. And then you'll see there'll be a link right on the front page to the Being and Becoming retreat. And then I wanted just to mention a couple of other things. Andrew Cohen is going to, for those of you that want to get a firsthand taste of Andrew Cohen, you know, before this retreat, if you live in the Boston area, he'll be teaching there this weekend, coming up. And again, if you go to enlightennext.org, you can get details under the events tab, and check it out. And then also he'll, if you're on the West Coast, he'll be in California, in June, and June, the weekend of June 23rd, he'll actually be doing two things. On the Thursday night, he'll be speaking with Rabbi Michael Lerner here about the future of God, and then he will be having on that Saturday, which is the 25th, I believe, we'll be having a half-day intensive in San Francisco, right by the, you know, with the view of the Golden Gate Bridge, this very iconic San Francisco location. So if you're on the West, you know, if you're near Boston or on the West Coast, those are two events you could definitely participate in. And of course, then there's the Being and Becoming retreat this summer, which is a kind of a mega event. And it's where, it, you know, anyway, I could say more about it. It's really where this dimension, this both the enlightenment dimension, but particularly the intersubjective dimension, gets explored and explored and explored more and more and more. And there's actual real time. I mean, there's new dimensions that get discovered even by Andrew on these retreats and the potentials between people. It's a collective exploration at the frontiers of consciousness. And there's always something new, something unknown that emerges from there. It's not, yeah, it's never the same old, same old. It's exactly the opposite, that you really see the, just the very edge of the possible continue to become, you know, more and more into focus and actualized on those retreats.
And I just want to end on maybe stepping into, I just want to share something, Michael, that was my experience over, you know, I first heard of Andrew Cohen in 1996. He came to London. I was living there and I got recordings of his talk and I saw him and something that I just noticed with Andrew, and I want to sort of break it open and sort of de-tabooize it in a way, at least for myself, because I've definitely noticed that for the longest time, I was totally hung up on his mustache and the fact that he's Jewish and the fact that he's waistcoat. And it's taken me this long to realize that he's absolutely not only not representing any of that, and even as an individual, I mean, his teaching is really beyond anything, any personality trait, really, as far as I can tell. From my own judicious analysis, it has nothing to do with any of that. And all of that came from my own cultural projections.
And well, I hear that. I mean, it's crazy. I hear that kind of stuff all the time. I can't stand the way he laughs. I mean, it's kind of...
Yeah,
I mean, I never know how to respond to things like that because I'm so continually blown away by who, as my teacher, by who he is and what he represents and the power of his transmission and also the extraordinary potentials that he's trying to actualize in the world. I'm so continually blown away by all that that I cannot relate to that sort of thing, but you do kind of hear it, and it's funny how, you know, it's on we so often just deal on in the surface of things, and can't ever really get past that to see the extraordinary depth behind it.
For me, I definitely know it's important to mention it, and when I sometimes talk to people, I can almost tell. I mean, even just the name, people are like, oh yeah, Andrew Cohen. I mean, I hear people say that all the time, like, oh yeah, he's a little cultish or whatever, and it's like I can tell in that moment that there's a gigantic cultural projection. And I'll just step into it and I'll just say, hey, you know, just try to listen a little bit to say this or that. I mean, I'm not pushy or anything, but for me, it was definitely important to mention because I think a lot of people have hang-ups about that. You know, obviously their own, nothing to do with him or the teaching.
No, I mean, it's true. And it's just, I mean, anyway, you know, I think it's a very tough role to play, to be a spiritual teacher, you know, a guru in a 21st century postmodern culture that, you know, that distrusts spiritual authority in all forms. And, you know, it's just, it's an incredibly difficult job, but, But I mean, thank God. You know, that's my take on it. Thank God for people, you know, for like, you know, Andrew Cohen and others like him, people who really are standing up with their life and bearing witness to spirit in the world, you know, and with every, you know, really with every breath they take, with every move they make, you know, giving kind of flesh and blood examples of the fact that, you know, as we like to say, spirit is higher. Consciousness is first. Consciousness is primary. It's the most important thing. And to have somebody whose actions really never betray that at all, you know, and who, yeah, it's just very powerful. And, you know, but it's tough in a cynical culture. And so, but so even more, you have to, I mean, at least I respect the incredibly heroic spirit of anybody like that who's willing to bear witness to consciousness, to spirit, and to that dimension of life being primary and fundamental above everything else.
Yeah. Well, Michael, we're just out of time, but I just want to thank you really from the bottom of my heart for coming on and talking with me. His book is 11 Days at the Edge, One Man's Spiritual Journey into Evolutionary Enlightenment. I believe it's going to be a modern classic, actually. I really do. I don't think I've seen something as detailed as this ever. So,
well, on that note, just before you go, I should you know, just to follow up on that, Andrew Cohen will be coming out with his new book, just called Evolutionary Enlightenment, in the fall, September, October. Look for it then. And it's, you know, it's his first book in years, and it's the only book where you know, his teaching is really fully articulated from him, from his own. Yeah, just from his own pen, basically, and it's the result of, I think, something like 8 years of just incredibly careful editing and work and commitment, and it's going to be out in the fall, and he'll actually be launching the book here in California. But I mean, certainly keep your eyes out for it, because it's a mind blower. I've had the privilege and the honor to read the manuscript, and it's gonna be a bombshell.
Great. Well, thank you so much. And of course, for any questions about the show, you can reach me at ZacharyFeder@yahoo.com. And Michael, thank you so much again. And I would just love to keep the conversation going, because I think, as I said, this is really a line drawn in the sand right through the heart of spirituality. And I think it's worth chronicling.
Great. Well, I would love to, you know, I would love to keep the conversation going. And, you know, we spoke a little about that earlier. Yeah, let's figure out how to do it. I would love to meet with you again this way.
Great. Okay. Well, thank you all for listening in, and we'll see you next week. Good night.